You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
To be honest, I think there's been a bit of a demographic shift that, you know, guys my age are retiring and they're not putting a lot of their money to risk as much anymore. Even the flow-through market here, which, you know, your U.S. clients wouldn't be impacted by, but there used to be a lot of doctors, dentists, lawyers that would typically put money in flow-through funds to get the tax advantage. So the Canadian government has changed some of those rules and made it a lot harder. So I think that's part of the disconnect. I think at some point when the gold price keeps going, because I think it is ultimately going to keep going here, then I think a lot of investors will come in.
Welcome back to MSE. This is Bill Powers. Thanks for tuning in to Mining Stock Education. And in today's show, we're going to speak to returning guest, Brian Christie. He has multiple decades in the mining investment sector in Canada. He's been a geologist, an analyst with Canaccord, a journalist with, I believe, the Northern Miner. He has been IR for Agnico Eagle, the gold producer, and he sits on a number of boards in the mining investment sector, and namely the chairman also of Fury Gold Mines, one of our show's sponsors, although we're going to be talking the broader sector in this interview. So, Brian, welcome back onto the program, and let's jump into it with BHP's multi-billion dollar proposed takeover of Anglo. What are your thoughts on this, and what's its significance?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that, copper is a very important strategic metal if you look at the electrification that's going on globally. And certainly, we already know that people like Newmont, Barrick, they all want to increase their copper exposure. So I think for, you know, BHP to jump in here makes a lot of sense. They divide up the company, get the copper assets, and build a bigger copper platform. So I think it makes perfect sense. I've seen, you know, research suggesting there's other potential bidders out there, which could be true. You've got Glencore, for example. A lot of people think it's probably too big a bite for the gold producers like Newmont and Barrick. But yeah, I think you're going to see consolidation across the industry. You know, there's been some gold transactions that people are basically consolidating assets, consolidating land positions. So it's, you know, part of what I think is to be expected moving forward.
So I've heard for over 5 years that the copper supply deficit will take place in 5 years. So, you know, that hasn't fully taken place. Copper's doing better recently. But do you think this is BHP's forecasting that copper supply deficit, and they're saying we're willing to risk, you know, on the South American assets of Anglo?
Yeah, it's funny, Bill, because I think a lot of the copper price moves are dependent on China, or if that's the dialogue, it's always what are the Chinese going to do? But I think, you know, if you look, as I said, with electrification, to get people into electric vehicles everywhere, you have to build out your grids, and that requires a lot of copper. I think that's going to ultimately, you know, put the floor under the pricing and probably ultimately take it higher.
From the investor perspective, when you get a big multi-billion dollar deal like this that goes through, you often see the bigger players divest of some of their, what they would call their second tier assets, but those assets could still have value in the hands of certain executives. So where would you be looking from the investor perspective post a potential transaction like this?
You know, I think they're going to spin out the platinum assets, stuff like that. I think a lot of what they're going to do is they're going to set up more individual platforms that'll be trading entities. So I don't know if this is going to be like what Newmont's doing, where they're selling individual assets to a broader market. I think the idea here is they'll strip out the copper, and then they'll have a few other vehicles that'll be listed and trade. So I'm not sure. What I think it probably tells you, though, is you should probably be looking at smaller scale copper producers. That's probably where the trade is.
Can there be too much merger and acquisition at the peak of a cycle? We hear a lot of talk about the need for consolidation, that G&A is too high, there needs to be consolidation. But is there such a thing as too much M&A?
I find it interesting, Bill. I've been at this a long time, and typically companies usually buy stuff at the peak as opposed to when you're in that trough. That's where you should be building your business and getting positioned for when the markets move, be it the commodity price or investors coming in. I struggle a bit. I don't see a lot of really solid assets out there for sale. And I think, you know, it's tough because with the gold price running up here, you know, we'll use the Newmont transaction, for example. Like, what are people going to pay for those assets? Are they going to price their purchase at, you know, 2,300? Or are they going to say, hey, I need some room, it's going to be 2,000? Because if you pick the wrong price and things, you know, revert, then it's, you're going to have a struggle on your hands.
You've been with Agnico Eagle doing IR for quite a bit. So what are some of the mistakes you've seen gold execs make at a peak of a cycle?
Well, typically guys would pay too much for assets. That was a historic adventure. I would say, I think the gold producers now are a lot more disciplined in what they're doing, because we haven't seen a lot of big transactions, and the ones you're seeing are more people cleaning up like joint ventures. You know, Equinox is a great example of that, where those guys, you know, took 100% of the asset. I think, you know, a typical one for Agnico was, we had the joint venture with Yamana on Canadian Malartic. As a joint venture, everything ran very smoothly. It was seamless. It was, you know, Yamana was a great partner, but I would say Agnico always kind of wanted 100% of that asset. And ultimately, with Pan American, we purchased Yamana, we took Canadian Malartic, they took most of the other assets. So it's just a matter of kind of cleaning it up, having 100%, because it allows you to do different things with the workforce. Like now, for example, all the Canadian Malartic employees, in the past, they were employed by the joint venture. Today, they're Agnico employees, and we have the ability to just move them around to wherever we need to move them. I think, you know, there was a period where we needed some grinding media at Detour that we just phoned up Canadian Malartic and said, hey, guys, can you help us out here? And everything just kind of flowed over to where we needed it. So owning 100% makes your life probably a lot easier in the end.
So the main strategic goal going into trying to own a 100% was the personnel, owning the personnel.
Well,
pretty much more,
yeah,
so
I think personnel, because that is a big problem these days, that it's tougher and tougher to you know, get the people, maintain and keep them. You know, a lot of guys use contractors, but even the contractors are struggling to get good people. So I think, you know, if you own 100%, you're a little more in charge of your own destiny when it comes to your labor force. It's also a procurement thing. When you can go out with, you know, if you have a multi-mine platform, it's a lot easier to talk to your suppliers and get better pricing on stuff as well.
When it comes to an exploration stage project, and maybe one that has a resource, when do you want to own 100%, and when do you want to leverage the money of one of the bigger players? Because I've talked to executives who given me either strategy and the pros of either strategy.
I think you probably always want to own 100%, because then you kind of control where it goes. And what you'll see with a lot of the smaller companies is they'll have a strategic investor. Like Agnico typically will invest in smaller companies, and then you've got somebody who's there that, you know, when you need to raise money, they typically always come in for their pro rata share of whatever has to be done. And they're also there if you need to maybe get some technical support or, you know, ask some questions. So I think that's probably the best way to do it, is have somebody that's a strategic investor that's helping you out.
When an investor sees Agnico, let's say, take a 9.9% position in a gold junior, should they feel confident in the technical work that was done prior to that investment? Like, what type of due diligence would a company like Agnico Eagle do?
Typically, they would come in and review block models, the resources. They also probably look at they'd have to be happy with social conditions as far as community engagement, First Nations, political risk. Agnico's probably on the other side of the political risk spectrum, that they tend to want to be in the safe jurisdictions and basically are. Whereas some of the other companies like Barrick or Newmont seem to have a little more higher tolerance for some of the riskier places in the world.
Keeping on the theme of mergers and acquisitions, G Mining Ventures and Reunion Gold announced a combination for the Americas gold producer. What do you think about this transaction?
G Mining, the guys, it's Louis Gignac, his group, they were consultants. I've seen projects where they've done some of the mining, or I think maybe, I'm not sure if they get into the metallurgy. So I'd say a good group. They brought their Tocantinzinho project online, timely, good cost control. And, Louis was in Guyana. So I think that actually, when I looked at that transaction, I said, well, that actually kind of makes some sense that, the people are coming together. They know that part of the world. And certainly, I think you want to get some scale because it helps if you get some liquidity in your stock as well.
What's your thoughts on the disconnect that many point out between the gold price and the stock price of the gold producers?
I think, a lot of people are kicking tires. They're doing their homework. I guess one of the bigger things we have now is the resource funds have kind of shrunk. They're not the players that they used to be back 10 years ago. They used to be a lot of the guys that would drive the activity, the investment. So they've kind of shrunk. We're more dependent on high net worth individuals, especially if you're a junior mining company, or generalist investors. So the generalist investors are a lot more risk adverse. So I think that's part of the disconnect. They're not necessarily moving down cycle. Like, they're okay owning a Barrick or an Agnico, but there's a certain point that they will go. And to be honest, I think there's been a bit of a demographic shift that, guys my age are, retiring, and they're not putting a lot of their money to risk as much anymore. Even the flow through market here, which, your U.S. clients wouldn't be, impacted by, but there used to be a lot of doctors, dentists, lawyers that would typically put money in flow through funds to get the tax advantage. So, the Canadian government has changed some of those rules and made it a lot harder. So I think that's part of the disconnect. I think at some point when the gold price keeps going, because I think it is ultimately going to keep going here, then I think a lot of investors will come in, because one of the problems is investors are often late to the party. They, wait for gold to be kind of a certain price level, and then they jump in, and then next thing you know, there'll be some movement in the gold price, and they often get caught offside.
So is the trigger then, or the catalyst to bring in more generalist interest, is it the gold price, or is it greater efficiencies or profitability from the gold miners?
Well, the profitability, you make a good point, because if you look at the big guys, they're struggling to get the operating margins, because what typically happened over the last probably 10 years was the gold price went up and they just changed their cutoff grade, and their operating margins were either flat, or when we hit the inflationary trends here, the operating margins went down. So it wasn't flowing through to the bottom line to investors. But I think a lot of the companies, and I know Agnico is very focused on keeping that operating margin strong, so that they can return capital to investors.
How important is it to know geology if you're a retail investor? If you rank it, now you are a geologist, so perhaps you're biased towards that, but I guess I'll give you my bias that it is important to know some of the basics, but I don't think it needs to be your strongest point as a retail investor in this sector, because there's so many other things you need to know. Do you agree with me, or would you take a different perspective?
No, totally, Bill. Okay. My criteria is management, 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 because you always want a management team that does what it says, and is very transparent in how they do things, because good management can often make tough assets work. Bad management can blow up good assets. So I think you always want to look at the management first. I think you got to look at political risk, because if you look at what's happening in the world right now, a lot of West Africa looks like it's potentially going to go off the screen here. You know, Niger, change of government there, Mali, there's noise that the Wagner group is coming in. The government may pull back some of those assets. There's a story today in Burkina Faso. So I think check out the management, look at the country risk, and then I think geology, yes, that comes into play, but it's down the list for me.
So that would be different than some exploration investors that I've talked to. They focus on geology, and what they've told me is that good geology will get rid of bad management, that it eventually will attract a good leadership team. Have you seen that play out that way in your career?
Good geology maybe attracts an acquirer, but the management.
So, like, if you get a screamer hole and you're like, well, I don't like that management team, but they'll put money in anyway because they said that was so good that eventually we believe that if something's here, it'll get in the hands of good management.
Yeah, but the problem is a lot of these guys over promote what they've got. So, yeah, you'll get a screamer hole, but you don't know the fact that two or three other holes are duds. So they've just kind of focused on the good stuff, whereas a good management team will give you the full picture, like, hey, this looks really good here. It's open. You know, it's cut off over here. So you got to kind of balance, the promotion versus the fact.
Okay. So the difference between promotion and a news release, or promotion and an economic study, you know, it's been said that even some of the engineering firms that do economic studies are biased because they want more clients. So therefore, they have to put out good results for their current clients. So, you know, when you were at NECO and you were looking at buying an asset, did you consider like what engineering firm did the economic study? And then how did you critique the economic study of that deposit or project?
To be honest with you, Bill, the big companies, when they go look at projects, they put their own team to work. So it doesn't matter who did the study. I'll take that back a bit. Like, you'll maybe have a preference that if a certain company did it, you know, that some of the guys that did it, so you're happy with the work. But for the most part, the big companies, they go in, they do their own work, they base their valuation on their own findings. That other study is, you know, kind of not all that relevant in
So is there a study that would compare those two studies, you know, to where like the internal team versus what was put out by, an engineering firm? That would be an interesting side-by-side study, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, because I always joke with people that there's never been a PEA that hasn't had a positive rate of return and NPV.
And then the economics always get better, right? And the CapEx lowers
exactly.
Towards the feasibility.
Well, the problem, Bill, is usually as you do more work and advance from a PEA to a PFS to a feasibility, your numbers get a lot tighter, and usually the values often go. But a lot of companies will offset, a change in economics with adding more ounces into the mine plan.
But isn't it like the numbers are something like 1 out of 8 actually fulfill the feasibility study numbers? Like it's something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right on that. That, as I said, usually when you tighten up on the engineering and costs, things often you lose some value. But that's when ultimately you can add ounces into a mine plan, extend the mine life, stuff like that.
Like to get your thoughts on the Save Canadian Mining movement that is speaking out against what they perceive to be naked shorting. There are investors also that are vocal that say the CEOs are whining a little bit too much and they just need to focus on running their companies and creating values. That's the other side of the argument. What would be your take? What's your observations, Brian?
I've seen it. I sit on a couple of different boards, and one is a uranium company. We've seen trades come in at 3:59 p.m. that downtick the stock, and it's like 500 shares. Another one of the companies I sit on they're seeing the exact same kind of trading pattern. So I don't think it's whining by the CEOs. It's a fact that I think the brokers, it's just another vehicle for them to make money. So it's unfortunate. And, you know, there's not a lot of ways around that. I'd say that probably one of the things I've noticed in a lot of these stocks is you often get a big uptick in the morning, and at about 10:30, everything kind of dries up. Things often sell off. Then you'll maybe get an uptick towards about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But I don't think you want to be there at 3:30 trying to buy or sell.
And is that primarily computers, algorithms?
There's a lot of this, quote, naked shorting. I think it's all algorithmic, that they just kind of put in a program and it plays through the program.
Well, Brian, thank you for this update. But before you go, what does Fury have coming down the pipe in terms of news flow?
I think some good stuff coming. We're nearing the completion of our updated resource at Eau Claire. I think that's going to be positive, and it'll give us a sense of where we might want to do some more infill drilling and, you know, maybe add some ounces ultimately there. We're looking at some of our peripheral targets at Eau Claire, the extensions, things like Serendipity, to go in and test some of the geochem that we've got there. We just completed an 8-hole program at our new Eleanor South property, which we acquired the other half from Newmont. So we've got assays at the lab. So I think you'll see some interesting information from that project. We've got some geochem that we have to do at Eleanor in the summer months. So we'll be pretty active. And I think we're going to be opportunistic on, you know, where we go, what we do. And, you know, the idea here is to focus on discovery, I think.
Excellent. Well, thank you for this update, Brian, and for coming on the show.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.